Storm.
All right. Welcome to Lost Bananas. I am Matt.
And I am Richard.
I woke up about 30 seconds ago.
Same here.
The time crunch, unfortunately. This one is guaranteed to be 45 minutes.
Yep.
Anywho, we talk about things in the entertainment industry that we find interesting. Mm-hmm. Movies, DVD, TV. Sometimes we completely ignore things or forget to discuss them, but that's okay because we're just a couple of idiots. by far the biggest opening this week would have been WALL-E, the new Pixar film, and I stunned myself by actually seeing it Friday night, opening night at 8 o'clock.
Wow.
We had a group of friends like a couple weeks ago said, oh, let's all go see WALL-E, and it's sort of like, come on, you're not going to wrangle, you know, approximately 10 people, you know, to go see something opening night and have it be at all successful. And yet, it somehow worked. We all managed to get tickets ahead of time. This was at Lincoln Square. And then we had dinner beforehand, and it ran late, and a couple of us ran up at 7:30 to go get seats, thinking there's no way we're all going to be able to sit together. It's all going to have to be twosies. We ran up. We found 7 seats in a row in the back row, and it worked. I was flabbergasted.
Wow.
Anyway, thoroughly enjoyed the movie. I thought it was great.
Cool.
You know, I had my typical high Pixar expectations, but I wasn't expecting, I just thought it would be a good, solid film. But, it did that, and it was more. It wasn't, I'd let it sink in for a little bit, but it wasn't as good as The Incredibles, which I think most people hold as sort of the pinnacle of Pixar achievement.
Most people? Really? I thought
yeah.
Most people thought Finding Nemo was the pinnacle.
Well, that's pretty good, but from my friends, and I read some, I think it was on the Daily Kos yesterday.
Yeah.
Just randomly, they were doing, hey, what's your favorite Pixar film? And the guy doing the survey said it was incredible, but I think everybody who had voted. But, that's just like a couple of random apocryphal things.
Yep.
Doesn't matter. Really, really enjoyed it. From what I said last week, I was wrong. It wasn't that it ended on a bleak note. You were completely right. It's that it started on a bleak note, which you could tell from the trailer, quite frankly. I thought they did a great job. I thought the fact that there was so little dialogue was really innovative, and that they told the story in a visual manner. And, it's not that it's silent. They have noises and all this stuff, but there is very little dialogue.
Cool.
And at the end, when you're seeing the credits, and you can see, let's see who did all the celebrity voices. There's like 5 voices total.
Mm.
And, my wife looked at it, and she's like, that's the shortest one of those they've ever had. And I was like, you're right. It's incredible. John Ratzenberger was one of them. It took me I could not figure out who was voicing the captain. I wanted to ask, it was the captain, but no, I got to figure it out. Turns out it was Jeff Garland, which I never would have gotten.
Jeff Garland.
I know who he is, which I doubt any of my friends did, quite honestly.
Curb Your Enthusiasm.
None of them watch Curb Your Enthusiasm. That's what he's most known for. I kind of know him for doing a few comedy routines, but I never would have gotten Jeff Garland ever.
Huh.
What to me was the most stunning was at the end of the film, we stayed through all the credits, and there's the MPAA. This film has been rated G.
Hmm.
And I thought, holy, when's the last time I saw a G-rated movie? Because I'm pretty sure the answer to that is Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Hmm.
Crying out loud, which nobody thinks is a G. But
was it Ratatouille G?
I assume, though, that... Hmm.
I thought The Incredibles was the only PG movie that Pixar's ever done.
Really? I just assumed they were all PG.
No, I thought. Well, I don't know. I may be wrong, but I was pretty sure that they were all G except for. But I may be wrong.
That's a stunning example of my not having done my homework before our little broadcast.
Here. Well, I might be totally wrong.
Doesn't matter. I enjoyed it. The auditorium really seemed to enjoy it too. And, thinking back to know, the past couple of Pixar films, you know, expectations have been ratcheted down a bit. You know, Cars comes out, and it, you know, people are saying, oh, it's too narrowly focused on people that like Cars, and yet it does pretty well. Ratatouille comes out, and you know, people, including Brad Bird, are saying, well, this is about rats. It's a tough sell, so it might not do anything. You know, that's, and the, some of the critics are saying that too, so that was coming from both sides of that one. And then on this one, it was more of a, well, it's a really hard film to market and describe. You know, there's not an easy hook you can sell it on, even though just in the past day or two, I think I heard people saying, oh, Andrew Stanton is saying it's a love story between robots and kind of Chaplin-esque, which is fairly accurate.
Yeah.
And some people, and I remember, it was this one guy whose site I used to read, Jim Hill, from jimhillmedia.com, who writes a lot of Disney stuff. I remember a couple of years ago, he was sort of putting up a warning flag, and I can't remember if it was him or someone else saying, you know, I talked to someone in Disney, and this is going to be a real roll of the dice, because it's so hard to market the film. But just the same, I thought it was a great film. You know, everyone was like oohing and aahing in the right spots, and I thought it was very, you know, they did a great job of anthropomorphizing this robot, and there was no Johnny Five to it.
Yeah.
You know, there was a little bit with the eyes, maybe, just because of the way they had to move it up and down that was perhaps a little reminiscent, but that was it. One thing, though, because, you know, Ben, I'm going to sort of use one of your phrases, Ben Burtt famously came out of retirement to do this. I say famously, I don't think anybody outside of nerds knows that.
Yeah.
But Ben Burtt's the guy who did all the sound effects and sound editing for the Star Wars films.
Yep.
So, you know, the sound of the lightsaber, the sound of blasters, you know, droid sounds, they're all because of Ben Burtt and his sound crew. So anyway, he came out of retirement to do the sounds for this film, and there's a couple of times that I actively thought, well, that sounds like R2-D2. Like, he went back to the well, maybe.
Yeah.
So anyway, I've been rattling on for a long time. I know that have you seen Wall-E?
No, I haven't seen it yet. We went and saw Wanted instead. And by the way, in terms of openings, yeah, Wall-E did great, and it's by a little bit the biggest, at least U.S. opening on a Friday ever, because a couple of the other ones did like 21 million, it did 23 million, but Wanted did huge. Wanted's going to make like $55 million, which stuns me. I mean, it's a pretty good movie, but it stuns me. This movie had such an enormous opening. I mean,
let me get one more Pixar thought before we move on to one.
Sure.
You know, everyone seems to think, you know, sooner or later Pixar is going to make a clunker.
Yeah.
And I'm not, you know, quite sure how people would define a clunker. Either it's not a critical success, and Cars didn't do that great with the critics.
Cars is the least beloved of it, and it still did pretty dang good.
Yeah, but, you know, how much money, will it either be that it doesn't make money, or that, you have to think the first Pixar clunker, if it happens, is still going to make a ton of money, because that brand name is so strong, even if there's bad word of mouth, the Pixar brand might be strong enough that people think, well, so-and-so says it's bad, but come on, it's Pixar.
Yeah.
So they might get the benefit of the doubt on that one and still make a ton of money. So I'm not sure how they would define a Pixar clunker, because I still think it would make a ton of money, but maybe it's just Universal bad word of mouth or a critical whatever. But I got to thinking, do they have to make a bad movie? They don't put out a lot of movies. It's, you know, was it one a year?
Well, sometimes even one every year and a half, but yeah,
and
just
they've
about
got this creative team that's still pretty much in place. You know, it seems, you know, John Lasseter pretty much took over Disney Animation as a whole after the merger, but from what I can tell, Pixar is still functioning properly, and as long as they've got the same vibe going on, I got to thinking, they don't have to make a clunker. Just because there's a law of averages that says they will eventually doesn't mean that it has to happen. With such a slow, you know, production rate, and if they've got the same team, you know, sort of saying, you know, we're making these films for ourselves, and if that's been working so far, I got thinking, everyone thinks that, or even I would think, sooner or later, they're going to make a stinker. But maybe they don't have to.
I know.
With them producing as few as they do, it's not like one just is going to slip through the cracks. I don't know. I got to thinking maybe they don't make a clunker and they just put out these awesome films.
Yeah.
You know, and just because nobody, you know, everybody, it's just sort of accepted sooner or later, everyone puts out a clunker or, you know, everyone stinks, everyone that's perfect will screw up, but maybe it won't happen. I don't know. What do you think about that? You think I'm high?
It's weird. Based on their track record, there is no reason to assume they're ever going to put out a clunker ever. Law of averages say it would happen, but there's no actual reason. Now that said, I'm looking at their the upcoming movies. I have no idea what this Up is about. But Toy Story 3 is the one that worries me, because Toy Story 2 was a great movie. It was better than Toy Story 1, in my opinion. But I'm wondering what the storyline's going to be there for Toy Story 3 and how that's going to be. And that's the one that worries me because... I'm sorry, go ahead.
They've talked about that before. I think they've actually talked about it on the commentary to Toy Story 2.
Yeah.
Because I specifically remember they were talking about, I can't remember how they were discussing the third film, if it was if we had done it or when we do it or before Disney was going to do their direct-to-video ridiculousness. But I remember them talking about, I think the end result was going to be that the toys end up in some kind of either community center. I don't think it was going to be a shelter, because that would have been kind of a down note.
Yeah.
But the toys end up somewhere where they would be used by different kids and enjoyed.
Yeah.
But they would still deal with the fact that the two core kids, whose names I can't remember, or the one core kid, you know, would eventually grow up, and he would have to do something with these toys and what happens to them that isn't depressing. And I think they said that it would probably end up that they would end, the result would be that the toys would end up in a community center or something like that.
Well, I imagine if anybody's going to do a great job, it'll be then. I'm just sort of thinking of, in terms of going back to the well, same characters, same kind of attitudes, new storyline, but to a certain extent, it's they're competing against themselves, and it might be hard to have it come out without it feeling a little bit old. But I don't know. Even Toy Story 2. By the time this movie comes out, Toy Story 2 will be almost a decade old at that point. So it's not like there's people are going to remember it that much.
I wonder if that was... I'd be curious to know what their motivation for doing it was. Because, you know, Disney, before the merger, was plowing full steam ahead with their Toy Story 3 without involving Pixar. And I know Pixar was pissed. Because... you know, they were just convinced that Disney was going to ruin it, and they probably would have.
Well, I almost wonder if that is their motivation, if they were so frustrated and pissed about what Disney's plans were that they, you know, it's almost like, who knows, but it's almost like a way they got so committed to this that they could be the only ones that do it, that's maybe they're doing it, because otherwise I don't see why they're doing it, or if there are, why isn't Finding Nemo 2 in the works? I know Cars 2 is in the works, which strikes me as awful.
Really? I haven't heard that.
Yeah, Cars 2 is one of their slated other ones, you know, one of their slated sequels. But
I did a search for Pixar's Next the other night, and that didn't come up, but that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, what was I just reading where they were talking about? They were talking about Cars too. But anyway, so I don't know. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was gonna say before we get into Wanted, I want to explain a little bit about what the movie or what it's based on.
Mm-hmm.
Before you talk about the movie, even though it means I've been talking like for a while now without a lot of Richard. Okay, so this is based on a comic book miniseries that came out not too long ago by a guy named Mark Millar. And it's essentially... I'm pretty sure the movie follows the comic all very closely, so I really don't need to explain the plot. But it's sort of an extreme comic. It's very graphic. You know, there's sex in it. There's swearing. And one of the big deals about it, and I'm kind of going to give away the last two pages here, I remember I just read this probably about a month ago in the collective form. And I was reading the introduction. The guy writing the foreword, the introduction, same thing. So, you know, those last two pages are the most mind-blowing two pages ever. I was like, okay. And I get to the last two pages, and it's basically the main character, you know, sort of breaking the fourth wall and talking to the audience and saying, you know, I used to be a loser like you living in my parents' basement, but now I'm a totally extreme assassin, and you're a loser because you're not doing anything more than your cube wall existence. Ha, 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 ha. You know, that's basically the gist of it. And yeah. I don't know if they did the same thing in the film, but I was like...
They did it for, like, they did it briefly.
I'm like, are you kidding me? That's your big extreme ha-ha moment?
Yeah.
What, are you five?
Yeah.
Anyway, so I read it, and I thought it was okay. It didn't really blow me away. You know, I kind of wanted to see the film, because it looked very stylized, and but it's unlikely I'm going to pay to see it in the theater. It's, you know, I'll probably borrow your DVD in 4 years. Anyway, so you saw it.
Yep.
Well, and before we get into that, we should mention, as you did, that it's making, I'm on the Wells site here, and he said, Wanted, Jesus Wept, to the 8.7.
Well, he hated it. He hated that movie beyond all reasoning, and the movie got, like, almost an 80% on the tomato meter. Which is killing him. He cannot quite understand that.
Yeah. Well, he said it ended up with 18.7 Friday night and will end up with 52.5 for the weekend.
Yeah.
Which, you know, he said 55. He said it was supposed to do somewhere over 30, but not more than 40.
Yeah.
Yep. Anyway, so...
Which I don't totally get, because to me the movie is very much in a similar vein as Clive Owen's Shoot 'Em Up. In other words, this hyper-stylized violence fun thing, and to me it was basically the same ride as Shoot 'Em Up. I have no idea why Shoot 'Em Up made nothing, and this would make all this money. You know, maybe a slightly better violence. It's directed by that guy, that Russian dude who directed Night Watch, which I bought 6 months ago and I still haven't watched, which I now want to watch. But apparently it's, you know, it's mostly just a whole lot of stylized, fun violence because there's no, the plot is so stupid and convoluted and doesn't make any sense.
I would say the differences between those are primarily money. You know, Shoot 'Em Up had Clive Bowman and Paul Giamatti. Paul Giamatti is not a name you can tell. He's getting more and more of a name. He's John Adams. But that's not really the same audience. But this one has Angelina Jolie, and it's got Morgan Freeman. And
But think about it this way: Angelina Jolie is a good actress, and this is about a perfect role for her. But she doesn't. She's not. She doesn't necessarily. I mean, I guess her most successful series are the Lara Croft movies, and those didn't make anything. And other movies she's been in just come and go often. So she's not exactly a huge name. And Morgan Freeman...
She's a much bigger name than the people who were in Shoot 'Em Up.
Yeah.
Even though you and I love the people in Shoot 'Em Up. I love Clive Owen.
I don't disagree. I just... There's nothing... There's not a single thing in Angelina Jolie's background that would have screamed to somebody, this movie's going to make $55 million in its opening weekend, you know? But anyway, regardless of that, the movie, you know, it was good in a lot of ways. It was dumb. You know, parts of it were, it just convoluted. It's a story of these, this thousand-year-old band of assassins that developed from a weaver's guild who go out and this loom of fate tells them who they need to kill to right the balance of the world. And somehow this loom of fate managed to miss Hitler and Stalin and other people, but it has them killing random people, which is so dumb. But a lot of the violence was inventive, and James McAvoy is terrific. He's a good actor. I didn't like him in The Last King of Scotland because he had this weird... nervous smile, which he was trying to affect, but it drove me nuts seeing him smile all the time in Last King of Scotland. But he was good in this movie, and it was fun. I'm just not quite sure why it was so you know, it was so popular. I took my mom to see it, and it's funny. Well, she wanted to see it. She liked it, but it's violent. A lot of slow motion, literally like bullets going through people's heads and other stuff. But because it's so comic booky, it doesn't really throw you at all. There's no real feeling violence like Saving Private Ryan. So, but anyway, I liked it. Angelina Jolie was about perfect for her role. And McAvoy was about perfect. Morgan Freeman, yet again, he's sort of settling into that comfortable, I'll take a paycheck role and do pretty much the same kind of job I do over and over again. I'm wondering when he's going to be his own, star in his own movie, and it's going to be a good movie, because he's sort of been comfortably placed in all these supporting role where he adds gravitas kind of things. And, you know, but anyway,
yeah,
not bad. I'm just stunned at how popular it is.
I ordered and received the latest Futurama movie / set of four episodes.
Beast of a Million Backs.
Beast with a Billion Backs.
Billion Backs.
I'm a huge Futurama fan.
Yep.
I popped it in, and it was okay. To me, it was not as good as the last one, Bender's Big Score.
Yep.
The humor was there. It just didn't make me laugh out loud. And Futurama usually makes me laugh out loud.
I'm gonna
trot out that old cliche. Even bad Futurama not exceptional Futurama is better than most other TV, which is true.
Yeah.
It was still really good. It just didn't. It wasn't as good as other Futurama. And this one had David Cross in it, which,
yep.
You and I are huge David Cross fans.
As the Beast.
And he was pretty funny. It's just that for whatever reason, it wasn't as funny as the other ones have been. And I really don't have much. I haven't listened to the commentary yet, but, since these are a lot of the same guys from the sim, Matt Groening, and for a while, I think he went back now, Bill Odenkirk.
Yep.
Bottom Kirk worked on both series. They all really do extras really well.
Yep.
They've got a lot of good extra stuff on here, and their commentaries are usually a good mix of, here's some technical commentary about how we made this, here's why we made these story decisions, and here's the voice actors being funny. Goes over pretty well. So
yeah, I've heard every Simpsons commentary and every Futurama commentary in there. Pretty much the gold standard, and mostly it's because the writers are so engaging. It's usually not the actors that are engaging, but the writers are very, very engaging, and they're great. I've always enjoyed them.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to mention that. Let's see what else I brought some other films from some other DVDs from my buddy John, because I was in the mood to see these. Mission Impossible 3, watched that again. Yeah, it holds up pretty well, actually.
Yeah, that was a good movie.
And I was able to listen to the commentary, because I totally forgot that J.J. Abrams did the film.
Yep.
And I was like, I really need to make time. I haven't heard a commentary probably since the last Futurama thing. And so I was working from home the other day and doing some I didn't need to think work. So I popped it in next to me and listened to the commentary, and it was pretty good. It was a little too, joshing around, me and Tom Cruise are so funny and buddies.
Yeah.
Because Tom Cruise is kind of like that.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty good commentary because, they mix it up and, they say, we shot it like this because of this and, we did, a mixture of how they made the film, why they made decisions, and, funny little anecdotes. And it's kind of weird to hear Tom Cruise say, on this day, this was the day I found out Kate was pregnant, talking about Katie Holmes.
And, yeah.
Weird to hear him discuss that like it's a normal thing, and also think of it as, wow, that's so weird, because everyone seems to think that you're this, you're this crazy-ass, Scientology dude, and it's been reported that, you offered Katie Holmes like a $20 million contract to be your wife, and there's all these popular, you know, popular culture jokes about how she's brainwashed or, you know, she's your captive or whatever, and you're just talking about it like it's normal, and it was just so weird to hear that. Anyway, pretty good commentary, pretty impressive, and what else did I watch? Oh, last night we watched Galaxy Quest again.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
It's a really good movie, and I remember thinking, it's not 100% perfect, but it comes damn near close to really writing this brilliant line. You know, it makes me think of the Futurama Star Trek episode, where Matt Groening said, if you love Star Trek, you'll love this episode, and if you hate Star Trek, you'll love this episode.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing about this movie. If you love Star Trek, you'll love Galaxy Quest. If you hate Star Trek, you'll love Galaxy Quest. It's a brilliant, brilliant movie. And I looked up the writer, whose name I don't have in front of me anymore. I have that close that window. But that was the only film he'd ever written. And there's like four conversation threads on IMDb, and one of the guys, you know, they're like, what else has this guy done? This movie was brilliant. And somebody said that he's actually a writing teacher at USC for one of their graduate TV screenwriting programs.
Huh.
And that is so weird. How do you have the restraint? Or, I don't know, it seems like if you sell a screenplay, you're trying to sell more screenplays.
Well,
you know?
He might have, and it's important to know there's some people that sold one screenplay, and they make $100,000-$200,000 a year in Hollywood just going in and working 3 days at a time fixing screenplays uncredited.
Yeah, and that could very well be what happened with this guy, because you do hear that. You hear that people make their whole lives, or making their whole lives telling scripts that never get made.
Yeah.
No one's ever seen or heard their work.
Yeah.
But it's too bad, because this was so good. You know, you're like, what? You know, I want to read more of this guy's work. You know, so I guess he's teaching. Hopefully, he's teaching the same good skills. But wow.
So my brother, I think I sent you an email about this, but I had an interesting an interesting factoid about my background and my brother's background. So I was looking on Wikipedia, and I realized that that actor who plays Dwight Schrute, Rainn Wilson on The Office. Pardon?
I was just thinking.
Yeah, Rainn Wilson. He
actually was one of the aliens in Galaxy Quest.
Yeah, exactly. I know. He went to my high school, and he was a year younger than my brother and 2 years older than me. And then my brother looked it up and realized, well, he also went to our junior high, and he also went to our elementary school. And somehow, I have no recollection of him. My brother doesn't either, which surprised me, because I remember tons of people, even in different grades, and I have no recollection. Well, then they talk about how he got the acting bug, because he was going to my elementary school, and he was in Your Good Man, Charlie Brown. And he talks about the day that the play was going to come up, and he broke his arm that day, but he so much wanted to be in the play that he showed up in a cast. And when he showed up there, he got some kind of, like, standing ovation when he showed up, in the second act as Schroeder with his cast on, and that did it for him. That sold it. Well, anyway, here's how it connects to me. That had to have happened when I was in second grade. Well, in fourth grade, I was in a Charlie Brown Christmas playing Schroeder. So, similarly to how Alec Baldwin created the Jack Ryan character, but it was ably filled by Harrison Ford, in the future Jack Ryan Hunt for Red October type movies, I followed up Rainn Wilson by taking over the Lake Forest Park production role of Schroeder. That's my brush is. But the weird thing is he had to have been, when I was in fourth grade, he would have been in sixth grade, and he had to have been in the play I was in. He had to have been in A Charlie Brown Christmas, because there was kids from all over it. And I have no recollection of him whatsoever. But he, if he was into plays, he would have been in that play, yet I don't remember him. And my brother, he would have been a year older than him,
And apparently he left, he moved to Chicago when he was like 16. But so my brother would have known him the whole time. None of us have any recollection. But apparently his dad or his mom runs a stall at the Pike Place Market selling jewelry, and his dad works at some sewer company in Seattle or something. And it's like, wow, I just had no idea. Anyway, I'm trying to look. My brother's pulling out his old albums, and he found one of them. He says he looks different. He had longer hair, but my brother found one of his old yearbooks, and he's gonna show it to me and see. But anyway, my brush with history. Rainn Wilson. So.
Any movie or TV stuff? I can talk about GTA 4.
No, I think Mad Men is coming out in about a week or something. And the new season of it, which I cannot wait. But other than that, there's not much new. I saw the they have these two new series on summer series on ABC. They've decided to go to the well of let's do those Japanese game shows. So one is basically an American version of the shows you see on Most Extreme Elimination, which is dumb competitions of human Tetris and other stuff. And then the other one is called I Survived a Japanese Game Show, where they take these people who they're going to be on a reality show, they think, and then they fly them immediately to Japan and they put them on a Japanese game show. Both great concepts, both absolutely fundamentally ruined by their execution. The Japanese game show, the funniest thing in the world would just be to put them on there. Have people screaming at them in Japanese, making them do stuff, and they have no idea what's going on. But what they decide to do is spend 80% of the time treating it like it's Survivor or MTV, the real world, where they're focusing on their mama-san in their apartment screaming at them and the things they get to win. And it's, no. Just have them be, you know, pummeled by weird stuff that makes no sense. That's what would be funny. I mean, they just ruined it. And then the other one is so much like Most Extreme Elimination, but then you realize why that show's so great, because of that ridiculous comical voiceover with these people. You have no idea what they're doing. Here, it's Americans with American hosts and announcers. I don't know. It sucked the complete life out of these two concepts. It's too bad. But anyway, that's it. That's it for me for TV.
I've never watched Mad Men. I know I should. I know you've recommended it. And it's got Christina Hendricks, who's a smoking hot redhead.
Yep.
Who I know her from Firefly, a couple of guest appearances there.
Yep.
Where you can see her mostly naked.
Nice.
But aside from that redeeming quality, she really played the role very well on Firefly. Trying to seem like less of a slime by praising her acting ability and not just her appearance.
Well, she's always wearing like tight sweaters in the show, because she's the little not vixen, but she's the office gal that is showing the other gals how you get ahead, kind of thing. And
I think I've watched any other DVDs recently. I've got the ones I bought. I still have two from you I need to watch, and then two from John. And I bought Michael Clayton, because I've been jonesing to see that.
Yeah, I still haven't seen that.
You can borrow my copy.
Cool.
What else? Oh, well, I guess I can move on to video games. Finally, yesterday morning, got in some Grand Theft Auto, and I'm finally over 50% done.
Nice.
although, I'm not sure if, based on something I read in one of the achievement texts, I'm not sure if that overall game progress meter is tracking to the...
No, that means nothing. You're probably pretty close to being done with the game. The 50% is... Have you done... Because Grand Theft Auto came up with their own version of achievements way before Xbox ever existed. So 100% means you've maxed out on every conceivable internal kind of thing they can do in a game. So whether they reflect achievements or not, but it's not how far you are on the actual progress of the game. In fact, I don't think I even made it to 50%, yet I completed the story mission.
Oh, okay.
So, in other words, like, I noticed you got the achievement for, you know, for getting this the score in darts. Well, I didn't care about that. Well, that adds to your 50%. So, in the era before achievements, the original achievement whores were the people that would sit there and play Grand Theft Auto religiously and would try to get 100%, and the hardest part was always finding the, you know, in Grand Theft Auto, it's finding the 100 or 150 pigeons to shoot. In the other ones, it was just like you had to come across like a star, a hidden star, and there'd be people religiously mapping them out and tracking down each of those stars, kind of like Crackdown. But, so that's where it's at. So you're probably pretty close to the end, depending on what the storyline is.
I'll tell you in a second. I finally, that stupid helicopter mission from last week I was complaining about, I figured out what the problem was. Well, I was doing the mission. I don't think it was quite pitch dark, but it was, well, it must have been, because I don't think their twilight lasts that long.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a dark sky, and I had been following the wrong aerial light. I think I had been following a plane, so I had been going in the wrong direction.
Ah.
And I found I kind of, anyway, it was very, very hard to see the helicopter I was supposed to be following in those lighting conditions. But I finally figured it out, and, you know, that was my problem.
There's a couple missions like that where I actually got it literally like on the first try, just fumbling through. Yet, trying to play some of these things again, I realized that it was such a fluke that had I not gotten it, I literally, it would have taken me like 4 hours or 5 hours of playing again and again to get to it. So sometimes there's missions in there where you sort of fumble through out of sheer luck, especially in some of the driving things that it had. When you play them again, you can't even come close, which is, you know, kind of crazy. Anyway, I'll bet you're pretty dang close to the end.
Well, story-wise, I was doing the Italian mafia guy, Ray Porcino, or whatever his name is.
Yep.
Doing his missions right now.
Yep.
I think
those are like maybe the last ones.
Well, except I haven't had any of the assassination.
Oh, but the assassination is, that's not really part of the game. You haven't gotten to the point where they've said, go to this phone booth and you can.
Nope.
Okay. Well, that happens, I think that's towards the end or whatever anyway, but again, that's not part of the storyline. It's just this phone booth you can go to and you get 9 missions, and they're, if you show up with a rocket launcher, they're the easiest things on the planet.
So that happens automatically, right? That notification?
Yeah, I think it's after something, but that said, I never got to the, I never figured out how you trigger the guy that can come deliver you guns, which I noticed you got that achievement. I can't figure out what you had to do that, because that never came up for me.
Well, it happened after the helicopter mission, when Jacob was in the helicopter. And, you know, the irritating thing about that is he calls me on the phone.
Yeah.
And I was in the middle of doing something else.
Oh, yeah.
And I kind of, like, I went into the cab, or I did something, and I come back out, and the conversation's gone.
Yeah.
So I don't actually know what, I don't know.
You can actually go and re-see those conversations. There's a, if you go into the menus, there's a place where you can, it will show all of the conversations that you had, so you can kind of go back and re-read them. But, yeah, I just could not figure out what triggered that, so I never got the guy to come deliver me guns, ever.
Hmm. Well, I got four achievements yesterday, and I was only trying for one of them, the Fly and Draw the Bridges one.
Yeah, I didn't even know that was an achievement. It's amazing.
Yeah, so
they get, was it tough?
To fly under?
Yeah.
Not physically.
So why the hell is it 40 points. It, I mean, that, god dang, those achievements for that game are crazy. 40 points. That's as much as you get for completing the whole game. I mean, you get 130 points for just finishing the you know, 40 hours of time, and they're giving you 40 points for something that's not that tough. That's just... Well, you know what I think about the achievements for that game.
Yes. Yes, I do. Anyway, so now that I'm past that mission that was holding me back, and apparently I'm nearing the end, so I'm looking for those assassination missions just so I can get the money, because I want that $500,000 achievement.
I think it's $600,000. Now, I told you where I was at. God, I'm literally like $25,000 away, but there's no easy way to generate that money because I've blown so much of it. You know, I sat there for not realizing I was blowing it by going and buying rockets for the rocket launcher.
Right.
But you're if you're even close and you haven't blown it on that, you're definitely going to get that because it's easy to generate a lot of money that way. But there's nothing like the other, like the last Grand Theft Auto where you could go to the parimutuel betting and you could bet on horse races. And all you have to do is kill the game and go there and bet. It was like video poker. But you could let it ride, and if you lost your money, you just go restart the game. But if you let it ride two or three times, boom, you've got like $10 million. And it just makes it easier. Well, they didn't allow that little cheat in this game, unfortunately.
Well, I saw from poking around, there's ways you can rob, you know, armored vehicles and whatnot, and it's just, it's great, because that's an interesting idea that I wouldn't probably think of on
but
my own.
I've never encountered them. Maybe I have. I don't know. Maybe they're hanging around banks or something. I've just never seen an armored vehicle.
Yeah, I don't know. There's one thing that's sort of a problem. You know, I was playing yesterday and talking to a friend about, getting through the game.
Yeah.
And he's like, you're not supposed to get through it. It's not getting through it. It's enjoying the environment. And I was like, you know what? It's a borrowed game, and I'm trying to...
Well,
he doesn't want it. I know you're not dying out of fact, but still, it's, you know, I want to get through it and get it back to you, because it's not my game.
Yeah.
But even if it wasn't that, there's Lego Indiana Jones I kind of want to play, whether I end up borrowing that from my friend in Utah or buying it myself. You've got these gigantic games, or games where you can pump an almost unlimited amount of time into.
Yeah.
Then it becomes, would you rather do that, and chase 100% completion, or chase an achievement, or just enjoy the environment versus playing a new game?
Yeah.
And it's this really interesting question of, if you're the only game in town, that's fine. You can spend all your time and hours in this environment. But if you're like coming at, if this had come out last Christmas and you're fighting Halo 3 and you're fighting whatever else came out last Christmas.
The Mass Effect.
If you come out this Christmas and you're fighting Gears of War 2 and you're fighting whatever else is coming out, if there's all this mind share competition, it's a lot harder to spend the time in these, choose your own adventure type of games. It's, at least me, I'm motivated to kind of get through the main story points and complete it.
Well, I generally am too. I generally am too, and I completed this game in 4 days. So, but I was of course fully committed to it. It was a full time job. But
You were hyper motivated. You were stoked about this game. You've been talking about it forever. So
yeah.
It was
literally the reason I bought the Xbox 360. Quite literally,
right.
I bought it 1 year to the day before it was announced to come out. Of course, they ended up pushing it back. But, anyway, well, it's 9:01, so we better wrap up, dude.
Okay. Before we do that, we've got Hancock is opening this week.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's getting some bad buzz.
Yeah, and apparently there's some big secret. They're saying the first half of the movie is exactly what you see in the trailer, but then it has this totally different half, and they had Charlize Theron on Jimmy Kimmel, and they were saying, don't let people know about it. There's the big secret, so they're pushing something there.
Well,
but there's so many weird things. You know, this movie is 80 minutes long?
I heard it was 90, but...
Well, of course, 80 minutes is what I heard, and when you're thinking about that, wow, what's going on? Last movie I remember that was that short was Men in Black 2.
You know what else was? Master of Disguise.
Yeah, Master of Disguise, 62 minutes. And that was not including, like, the 10 minutes of goofy outtakes. Unbelievable.
Yeah, so it's weird, because usually Will Smith,
she delivers all the time, man. So I don't know what's going on here.
It'll have a good opening weekend, but it might drop off really high.
Yeah.
My wife really wants to see it, because she really likes Will Smith.
Well, I want to see it because it has a BMW 2002 in it.
Oh, that's right.
That's what Jason Bateman's driving, and boy, all the little BMW 2002 communities, they're a buzz. That guy who's doing that documentary about them that he interviewed me, I emailed him and go, are you aware of this? He goes, oh, yeah. Yeah, I talked to the producer and he interviewed somebody who and why they put that movie in or that car in. And so he's already done, like, some segments about that movie, which is pretty lame. But anyway.
And then we've got Dark Knight coming out pretty soon. Yep. There were some early reviews I've been avoiding. Although, from what I can tell, people are really, really enjoying it.
Yeah. Yeah, and also Hellboy 2 comes out in 2 weeks, and I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Yeah, that looks really, really good. It's like they're developing, and I don't know.
I liked it because, just the visual flair of the movie, they seem inspired. So much of it reminds me of the amazing visual flair of Pan's Labyrinth, and he's going in that direction a little bit, and I thought, oh, good, because it looks cool.
And they're playing that up in the marketing, from the director of Pan's Labyrinth.
Yep. Which is really cool when you think about it, because Blade 2 is the biggest movie of his career, far and away. Hellboy is probably 2. Pan's Labyrinth, huge movie, nominated for 5 Academy Awards, but it really only made about $30 million, which is incredible for a foreign language movie, but not huge. But they're recognizing, the cachet of Pan's Labyrinth, that's what we got to sell it on. Blade 2... Nobody's going to go see this because he's the director of Blade 2. So, yeah. They had him on Jimmy Kimmel. He was talking a bit about the next 4 years of his life in New Zealand, and that seemed, a lot. But cool nonetheless.
So, yeah, that's what's coming down the pike that we will be eagerly looking forward to and discussing.
Yep.
All right, so we'll wrap this up. You guys rock at mustardama.com. It's how you reach us.
Mm-hmm.
I am Matt.
I am Richard.
Thank you for listening.